The headlines this hour. Iran says it will return to the talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal after reviewing the details of previous negotiations. Taiwan expresses concern about what it calls Chinese military activities over its airspace and warns Beijing's actions risk regional peace and stability. And Asian stock markets fall to near one-year lows, extending a global slump as soaring oil prices put forward upward pressure on inflation. Thanks for joining us. Iran has reiterated its readiness to return to talks for reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, but says that it first needs to review the minutes of previous negotiations. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says the talks in Vienna could restart by early November. Khatibzadeh, however, says the stumbling block is the removal of 800 sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it left the accord in 2018. The senior U.S. official has said that Washington hopes for the resumption of the stalled discussions in a short period of time. But the unnamed official has added the path for the negotiations will not remain open. Iran and the remaining signatories have held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital since April to restore the troubled pact. Brian Berletech is a journalist and political analyst who joins us. Iran has said that it is willing to return to the talks, but it wants to review the minutes. And there's also talk about the funds that is frozen in, I believe, South Korea, that it needs. Iran said that that should, as goodwill gesture, be released, which the U.S. has rejected. What's your assessment of these talks at this point?
This goes all the way back to the Trump administration when the United States walked away from the agreement. Iran was upholding its side of the deal. The U.S. walked away in bad faith, and now with a new administration, they're saying that they're interested in possibly restarting these talks, but they're not admitting their mistake in leaving the talks without reason and penalizing Iran with these sanctions. And the first thing that they should do is come back to the table, take down the sanctions, and then go from there. And I'm sure that Iran would be more than interested and willing to go back to the deal. It benefits Iran.
Iran has said that they want nothing more or less than what was signed, and that was the 2014 or 2015 nuclear deal. Why is the U.S. then not doing that, of course, given the fact that Iran has requested sanctions to be lifted?
Essentially, the U.S. is obsessed with regime change in Iran. This is no secret. They have pursued this for decades. It could be speculated that the deal from the very beginning on America's behalf was kind of a trick in a way to bring down Iran's guard, to make the United States look like it was trying to be reasonable, and then to paint Iran as being unreasonable for alleged breaches in the agreement, which the United States has never seriously even come close to proving. And so this was just another stepping stone towards this hostile posture the U.S. has towards Iran, as it has a hostile posture towards many nations around the globe. And the sanctions is not unique to Iran. They have done this to many other countries as well. So it's a pattern of the United States being unreliable on the global stage when making these deals.
Thank you for that, Brian Berletech, journalist and political analyst from Bangkok. On to Syria. Syria has praised Iran and Russia for the role that they played in the Arab country's victory over foreign-backed terrorism. In an interview with the Lebanese television network, Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Ayman Susan called the two countries partners. He said both Tehran and Moscow helped Damascus foil a huge plot hatched by the U.S. to advance Israel's interests. He also hailed the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah for supporting the Syrian army in its fight against terrorists. Susan said the Arab nation is about to achieve the final victory in the war imposed over 10 years ago. Taiwan has criticized China for what it called over-the-top military activities over Taiwanese airspace.
Taiwan definitely needs to be on alert. China is increasingly over the top. The world has also seen China's repeated violations of regional peace and pressure on Taiwan. So democratic countries have repeatedly issued warnings that their countrymen have to be self-reliant. We have also seen President Tsai ceaselessly supporting the national army. We must come together as one and strengthen ourselves. Only then will countries that want to annex Taiwan not dare to easily resort to force.
The Taiwanese premier said the region does not seek military confrontation, but he added Taiwan will do whatever it takes to defend itself if its democracy is threatened. The self-ruled island says dozens of Chinese aircraft have flown over its airspace since Friday. China considers the island as its own territory and is opposed to Taiwan seeking independence. China is also opposed to the military support Taiwan receives from the U.S. Beijing says that Washington is threatening regional peace and stability. Asian stock markets suffer heavy losses and plunge into multi-month lows following a broad sell-off on Wall Street. Japan stocks were down 2.8%. MSCI's broadest index of Asia-Pacific shares dropped 1.3% also. It reached 619.87, the lowest since November 2020. The drops come as investors get frantic about the impact of the soaring oil prices and supply chain disruptions. Oil prices have jumped to their highest level since November 2014. That happened after OPEC member states and their allies decided to hold to their planned output increase. India has reported more than 18,300 new COVID infections in the past 24 hours. That is the country's lowest daily caseload since May. Health authorities also reported 263 new daily deaths. Total COVID fatalities in India now top 449,000. Its total infections are above 33.8 million. The country was hit by a surge in the disease in April and in May. That saw infections reach over 414,000 and deaths above 4,500 a day. The surge was blamed on people's reluctance to wear masks and underfunded medical infrastructure. India tackled the crisis by launching a mass vaccination campaign. After their takeover of Afghanistan in August, the Taliban have been confronting militant and terrorist groups, especially Daesh, in the country. This has sounded the alarm in the war-torn country that is struggling dire economic problems. Rahmatullah Baghman reports from Kabul.
After 2 decades of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, the country is still the scene of daily attacks by terrorist groups. The Taliban government is now confronting terrorist groups, especially Daesh, raising the possibility of a wider conflict in the Central Asian country.
I think the war has not ended in our country. The Taliban talk about establishment of peace and security in the country after the U.S. withdrawal, but Daesh still poses threats against the government and the people. Afghan civilians are still losing their lives on a daily basis.
At least 8 civilians were killed and 20 others wounded in an explosion claimed by ISIL on Sunday in the Afghan capital Kabul. This comes as the Taliban have always claimed Daesh has no place in Afghanistan and they don't see ISK as a significant threat. They say security has been assured in Afghanistan since the U.S. withdrawal and country has been saved from the quagmire of war.
The main security challenge against the Taliban government can be Daesh and other terrorist groups whose ideology aren't the same as the Taliban. Daesh has the potential to create major problems against the newly established Taliban government in the future.
The recent bomb attacks in eastern Jalalabad and Kabul put a big dent in Taliban's claim that this country is seeing unprecedented peace and security. People of Afghanistan say they're tired of endless war in their country and can't tolerate more civilian casualties. The growing security challenges in Afghanistan come amid an economic meltdown as the Taliban struggles around the country with no considerable foreign aid. In the meantime, international organizations have warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of Pakistani officials, including former and sitting ministers, have been found to have hidden their illegal wealth in offshore companies abroad. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has called for an investigation into new documents which have exposed the hidden wealth of many world leaders in similar fashion. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Pakistani politicians and former top civilian and military officials are in the spotlight after they were named in Pandora Papers scandal. There are as many as 700 Pakistani politicians, retired civilian and military officials whose names surfaced in the scandal. Among them, also included sitting ministers and close aide to the Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose government came into power in 2018 with a pledge to end rampant corruption. Pandora Papers are based on 11.9 million documents from 14 firms, mostly in British Virgin Islands and the US, where many world leaders and top officials, including from Pakistan, hid their allegedly ill-gotten money by setting up anonymous offshore companies.
How ironic it is. Look at the sheer numbers of military generals and bureaucrats and members of current government who have been named in Pandora leak. They all are involved in this mega corruption.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has ordered an investigation into the scandal.
Although Mr. Imran Khan has been presiding over a team of these crooks and gangsters who have now been exposed in these Pandora's leaks, he has been closely working with these ministers whose names have come up. But at the same time, he would like to distance himself from these crooks and gangsters in the name of the so-called investigation that he's likely to initiate very soon.
Prime Minister Imran Khan's predecessor Nawaz Sharif was ousted from power in 2017 for possessing overseas assets beyond known means of their income, after a similar scandal known as Panama Papers surfaced. Since then, many tax amnesty schemes have been introduced to legalize the hidden wealth of politicians and officials in and outside Pakistan in return of tax penalties. Therefore, many believe the corrupt elements are likely to get scot-free once again. Pandora Papers scandal is likely to die down in Pakistan, given the fact that this time around, the powerful military seems to have no appetite to play its role to oust the current government, unlike in 2017, when the military fully backed the judiciary to oust the then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif after he clashed with the army on issues linked with the foreign policy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
French President Emmanuel Macron has called for dialogue with Algeria to resolve a political and diplomatic row. Macron says that he wants tensions between Paris and Algiers to be eased via talks. Relations have turned sour since last week when France announced plans to sharply reduce the number of visas granted to Algerian nationals. Things became worse after remarks attributed to Macron about Algeria's modern history. The French president reportedly said that Algeria has been ruled by a political military system that has totally rewritten its history. The developments prompted Algeria to recall its ambassador to Paris and to close its airspace to French military planes. The European Commission president says that Brussels needs to do more to combat tax evasion. This follows revelations about offshore assets of dozens of world leaders and politicians.
Tax evasion and aggressive tax planning is completely unacceptable. And we have in the European Union some of the highest tax transparency standards in the world. But as we see, it's not enough. More work is needed. And that's why we will come forward with a proposal on the misuse of shell companies for tax purposes, and this will be done till the end of the year. So we'll come with an answer to the obvious problems that are still out.
Ursula von der Leyen was responding to reporters' questions regarding the so-called Pandora Papers. The documents detail how dozens of current and former world leaders and public officials have used offshore tax havens to stash assets worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The allegations made in the papers range from corruption to money laundering and tax avoidance.
It's being described as the Panama Papers of 2016 on steroids. The Pandora Papers, a leak of almost 12 million documents allegedly linking some of the world's richest and most powerful to huge secret assets, tax avoidance, and money laundering. It's the job of hundreds of journalists in more than 100 countries, spending months combing through files as part of the largest ever global financial investigation. Among their findings, secret financial dealings of the King of Jordan, President of Russia, the President of Kenya, and hundreds more politicians and celebrities, some of whom allegedly use shell companies to buy properties here in the UK.
Oxfam have calculated that amount. The amount concerned comes to some $427 billion lost to national economies and tax around the world, money could be spent on hospitals, schools, all the things that the masses of the people need, especially as we come out of this global pandemic and the economic crisis that that has spawned.
One of the two British names so far in the revelations, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who allegedly avoided paying hundreds of thousands in property tax on a townhouse while buying the company which owned it.
And this is a guy, Blair, who never tires of going around the world telling other people how they should live their lives. He's treated as an elder statesman in British politics. The media had never done having him on their show to give his views on all the issues of the day. A man who's got the blood of a million Iraqis and more in the region on his hand.
The other Briton named Mohamed Amirsi, a major Conservative Party donor who funded Boris Johnson's campaign to become Prime Minister, involved in one of Europe's biggest corruption scandals. The UK Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has promised an investigation into the revelations, but when asked whether he was ashamed that London is a haven for those looking to get out of paying their fair share, he said he was not.
He himself is a former top executive of Goldman Sachs, so he's plugged into this kind of thing. He knows it goes on. I'm sure sotto voce he would say that's part and parcel of the game.
Some are now questioning whether the UK is doing enough to regulate the use of shell companies and tax avoidance measures. Analysts say this makes it harder for citizens to trust their leaders. For now, those allegations in the so-called Pandora Papers are, well, allegations. There's no proof that any of the individuals mentioned in this story broke any laws. But whether those laws will have to change is something that the public will have to debate and decide. Saeed Tourism, London.
And that is it for this edition of World News. Bye bye for now.
We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the passing away of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on this day of mourning.
Imam Hassan's political perspective. In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Today, the 28th of the month of Safar, is a day of double grief. In the Prophet of Islam passed away on this day in 11 AH. His elder grandson was martyred through poisoning on this same day, 39 years later in 50 AH. Here we present you a special feature on Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, on his political perspective. Stay with us, please. Hassan and Hussein are imams, divinely designated leaders. Whether they siege, make peace, or rise with the sword against deviation. This statement from no less a personality than the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind with the universal message of Islam is proof of the unrivaled merits of his two grandsons, whom he also hailed as leaders of the youth of paradise. These merits of the two brothers who salvaged Islam into different ways within a period of 20 years in accordance with the political conditions of their times against two avowed enemies of the mission of the grandfather, the Prophet of Islam, having contrasting approaches to deceive and destroy Muslims, are mentioned in all books of hadith and history of both the Sunni and Shia Muslims. If in 41 AH Imam Hassan, peace upon him, had to resort to the master stroke of truce to unmask the hypocrisy of the Umayyad rebel of Ibn Abu Sufyan by relinquishing the caliphate, a political rule that was worthless when compared to his spiritual authority as the divinely designated leader of mankind, his younger brother Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in his own capacity as God's representative on earth, had to court martyrdom on the battlefield in 61 AH along with his sons, brothers, nephews, cousins, and loyal companions to expose Yazid ibn Muawiyah as a heathen with not even remotest connection to Islam. In other words, in the same manner that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, had given his support to his elder brother's decision to kick the caliphate away in order to uncover Muawiyah as a crafty criminal, undermining Islam by masquerading as a Muslim, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, if he had been alive to see the accursed Yazid seizing the reins of caliphate, he would have adopted his younger brother's tactics to rise against the godless despot and court-martyr them on the battlefield in order to save Islam and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. To be more precise, the mission of a divinely designated leader is to preserve the genuine teachings of the Prophet in the face of apostasy, hypocrisy, distortion, and deviation by means of political prudence and as per the changing circumstances, as was shown by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. In 11 AH, his right of political leadership, which was so clearly specified by the Prophet of Islam on 18th of Dhul Hajjah 10 AH at Qadir Khum, was usurped by a group of neo-Muslims. Imam Ali, peace upon him, the person who had single-handedly won many a crucial battle, didn't unsheathe his sword, but allowed the caliphs to continue the rule of the Islamic State out of concern that an armed encounter would make the majority of the Arabs revert to paganism, and in addition would indicate that he was thirsty for power at all costs. Yet a quarter century later, when the caliphate came begging at his doorstep, and Imam Ali, peace upon him, reluctantly assumed political power, he didn't sit quiet against the oath breakers, seditionists, and renegades. He crushed their rebellions on the battlefields of Jamal, Safin, and Nahrawan for the sake of preserving Muslim unity and the teachings of his Prophet, even if it meant he would be martyred. Thank you. Thus, as the divinely designated heirs to their Immaculate Father, both Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them, for the sake of Islam, adopted prudent policies, irrespective of the loss of the caliphate for the elder brother or the loss of life for the younger brother. Since today is the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, in 58, it will not be out of context to focus briefly on his political perspectives, which he brilliantly outlined in one of his sermons, saying, "Politics means observing the rights of God and the rights of the living, and the rights of the dead. The rights of God mean that you should obey his orders and avoid what he forbids. The rights of the living mean that you should observe your duty to your brethren and not tarry in serving your people. You should be faithful to the one in legitimate authority among you as long as he is faithful to the people. You should speak up in his face should he deviate from the right path. The rights of the dead mean that you should remember their good deeds and overlook their bad ones. They have a Lord who shall ask them about whatever they did." Following the martyrdom of Imam Ali, peace upon him, on the 21st of Ramadan, 48, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, was acknowledged by the masses as the caliph of a realm that stretched from North Africa to the borders of China in Central Asia and which is now made up of at least 20 countries. It was a vast realm whose western parts were being gradually seized by the bloody thirst for political power of Muawiyah and his comrade in crimes against Islam, Amr ibn As. Imam Hassan, peace upon him, showed his political astuteness by mobilizing a force of 40,000 and marching to meet the enemy. When, however, he found that the satanic stratagem of Muawiyah, whose wanton killing and pillaging of Muslims, coupled with pretensions for peace, had weakened the faith of the Iraqis and made them lose the stomach to fight deviation, he decided to relinquish the caliphate, but on certain conditions in order to expose falsehood in its true colors. In addition to the hypocrites within his own ranks, who at least twice attempt to assassinate him, and the treason of his military commander Ubaidullah ibn Abbas, who deserted and demoralized the 12,000 army sent by Imam against the Syrians by crossing over to the side of Muawiyah and being bribed, he was also aware of the fact that Emperor Constantine of Byzantine or the Eastern Roman Empire was closely watching events in the Islamic world. The Christian power was looking for an opportunity to seize Baitul Muqaddas by taking advantage of the intended civil war of Muawiyah, who was a pagan at heart and a reluctant convert to Islam as late as 88, at the peaceful surrender of Mecca to Muslims some 2 years before the Prophet passed away. Thus, the fall of Palestine to the Byzantines would have forced the people of Syria and even of Egypt, both of whom were new converts to Islam, to return to Christianity and place their countries again under Roman rule. This is further proof of the political foresight of Imam Hassan, peace upon him, his God-given spiritual powers that no political usurper could seize nor any traitor could harm deemed it prudent to give up political power in order to save Islam and Muslims from both Umayyad hypocrisy and European hegemony. Moreover, like his father, he had neither attachment to worldly rule as power-hungry and unprincipled politicians have, nor could he be heedless of the Prophet's needs and sufferings as a result of unnecessary spilling of blood in an atmosphere where beliefs were still confounded because of the sedition wrought at Saqif ibn Saud. No sooner had his grandfather left the world. Thus, on 26th of Rabiul Awwal, 41 AH, after 6 months as caliph, he took the politically prudent step of concluding a treaty with Muawiyah that was as decisive as the Prophet's treaty of Hudaybiyah with the Meccan infidels, which God has hailed as Fathul Mubin, meaning manifest victory in the Noble Quran. It is worth recalling here that at Hudaybiyah in 70 AH, while the four-year-old Imam Hassan, peace upon him, was endeared by Muslims as Rayhanatul Rasul or Bezel of the Prophet, the 27-year-old Muawiyah was still a pagan and an open enemy of Islam, along with his equally accursed parents, Abu Sufyan and Hind, who had tried to chew the ripped-off liver of the Prophet's uncle Hamza after having martyred him at the Battle of Uhud. Among the stipulations of the treaty was that Muawiyah should rule according to the Book of God and the Sunnah of the Prophet. He should stop his pagan practice of insulting the name of Imam Ali, peace upon him. He should not shed Muslim blood in pursuit of his political ambitions. He has no right to nominate any successor. The caliphate should return to Imam Hassan, peace upon him, after him, and the revenues of the district of Darabgard near Shiraz are assigned for the upkeep of the families of those who attain martyrdom in the battles imposed upon Imam Ali, peace upon him. In his greed for the caliphate, the avaricious Muawiyah agreed to the terms of the treaty, but soon, to the horror of the deceived Iraqis, he breached each and every of its clauses. He told them that from now on, it is the swords of the Syrians and their necks if they were to oppose Umayyad policies. The ingrates had learned it the hard way not to trust the occupiers and the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. For his part, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, relinquished the caliphate and retired to Medina to carry on the mission of his grandfather, while the usurper Muawiyah broke all commitments to the clauses of the treaty. He transgressed the rights of God through sins in public, violated the rights of the dead Muslims whose image he tried to tarnish by reviling their blessed memory, including that of Imam Ali, peace upon him, suppressed the rights of the living by killing and tyrannically exploiting them. Had Imam Hassan, peace upon him, fatally poisoned and towards the end of his long rule imposed his libertine son Yazid as heir, a most abominable crime in the history that was defeated at Karbala by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who sacrificed his life to salvage Islam in 61 AH. On the 28th of Safar in 50 AH, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, departed from the world as a martyr. On being fatally poisoned by an agent of Muawiyah, whose forces in Medina riddled the coffin and corpse of the Prophet's elder grandson with arrows before he was laid to rest in Baqi Cemetery. Alas, in 1925, the Saudi seditionists, on seizing Medina, desecrated the sacred Baqi Cemetery and destroyed the magnificent mausoleum housing the tomb of Imam Hassan, his nephew Imam Zain al-Abidin, his maternal grandson Imam Muhammad Baqir, and the latter's son Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon them. The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. A new study shows U.S. police killings are undercounted by more than half over the past four decades, resulting in the death figure being cut off by over 17,000. The study conducted at the University of Washington raises questions about racial bias among medical examiners and highlights the lack of reliable national record keeping. It compared death certificates with data from organizations that tracked U.S. police killings between 1980 and 2018. Findings also pointed to disproportionate killings of African Americans who were fatally shot at a rate of 3.5 times more than their white counterparts. Co-lead author of the study says they realized a vast discrepancy while reviewing police violence data after the 2020 murder of George Floyd. According to the paper, the undercounted killings are not necessarily missing, but are miscategorized. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Colin Kemp, who's with us from Washington. Colin, what do these numbers mean?
Well, these numbers mean that they are not really dedicated to understanding just how deleterious police involvements are when it comes to shootings and its impact on the black community and communities of color, as we see that there are disproportionate ways that communities of color are affected by police shootings. Now, of course, this is not a new conversation. This is something that has been discussed for decades, but still we haven't seen that will coming from politicians or from the police to really track these shootings more accurately. What does that do? Well, that sets in place white hegemony, that power struggle that whites have struggled and wanted to maintain throughout decades since the founding of this country. And they do it using the police force. And then we see that it goes to another level on the stretch or the lengths of fatalities that black people and communities of color suffer at the hands of police. And so what there needs to be is reform to how these records are being collected, the reports that are being made, and the repercussions that happen when there is a police shooting and someone dies, and it's very unclear whether or not that shooting was necessary. The high-profile cases, we do hear about those, like George Floyd, not a shooting, but still a police killing. But there are so many other shootings that happen across the country that go unreported, that don't get the media spectacle that other cases do. And these still leave behind shattered lives, families, friends, brothers, sisters, you name it. These people are all victims of police shootings, and then their families are also victimized as well. So this really has to be taken a lot more seriously, something that hasn't been done in the history of the U.S., and it's just now being revealed. I would suppose that there are going to be advocacy groups that will really try to campaign to the president to take a stand on this, whether or not it's something that he has his Justice Department adjust, at least federally, and then hopefully it trickles down to states and then local municipalities. But something needs to be done as of yesterday, in fact.
All right, thanks a lot. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington, D.C. Our guests joining us on tonight's Spotlight are former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C. and Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Gerald Horn, who's with us from Houston, Texas. Well, let's start off with Mr. Horn in Houston. Welcome to the program here on Press TV Spotlight. This report found that between 1980 and 2018, more than 55% of deaths from police violence, that's over 17,000 in total, were either misclassified or went unreported. Plain and simple, is this a cover-up?
It is a cover-up. It's a tragedy. It's also a crime against humanity. As you may know, the black community through our organizations have been clamoring for a United Nations human rights investigation of this quasi-genocidal pattern that has been inflicted upon the black community. And I urge and encourage the international community to move with all due deliberate speed to intervene, because what's going on cannot be allowed to continue. You should also know that in today's newspapers, there was another stunning article about the fact that as of 2020 alone, there were thousands, 70,000 cases of missing black girls, girls under the age of 18. Where have they gone? Where have they disappeared to? At the same time, black children only are 14% of the nation's children population, but they're 31% of the children that are missing. What's going on in the United States is obviously an outgrowth of slavery. It's obviously an outgrowth of the unresolved issues that followed slavery, speaking of the hated apartheid system known as Jim Crow. And you should know that that system only began to retreat because of international pressure. And I dare say that today's tragedies will likewise only retreat under unremitting international pressure.
Matthew Fogg in Washington, D.C., do you agree with Mr. Horn? This is an effort to conceal the truth. Even so, the figures are still too high anyways, aren't they?
Oh, the figures are staggering. I mean, when you look at the numbers of the percentage of African Americans that live in the United States, and you're talking about the numbers, the disproportionate numbers of those that are missing or having some type of a negative impact in their life, it's crazy. I mean, yes, I agree 100%. Until this country recognizes that it has a racial issue that is perpetuated from slavery and all the way back, and that the country is still very much divided on this issue, we're going to have problems. It's definitely in law enforcement, that's for sure.
Let's go back to Mr. Horn. The study, it discovers that black Americans are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans, and Hispanic people are killed at a ratio of 1.8 times higher than non-Hispanic white people. The review of data shows that many fatal police encounters are misclassified, but often most often when the victim is black or Hispanic. Again, the minorities here bear the brunt of all this. Tell us more, please.
Well, it's interesting. The study that you mentioned references killings by the police. But keep in mind, there are other cases that even this study, as significant and profound as it is, did not encompass. Recall that just a few years ago, not far from where I'm sitting in Houston, Texas, there was the case of the young black woman, Sandra Bland, who was pulled over by the police because of a traffic violation, was taken to jail, and apparently was so harassed and so traumatized by being in prison that she hung herself. So that would be classified as a suicide, although it's fair to say that the proximate cause of her death was her maltreatment and mistreatment by the police. You should also know that just recently in the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C., there was an attempt to pass a change in the law, the so-called George Floyd Policing Act. You referenced George Floyd, the black man in May 2020 in Minnesota, who was killed on camera at the hands, or I should say at the knee, on the neck, administered by a Minnesota police officer. But what's striking is that the Republican Party, the opposition party, did not negotiate in good faith. They basically claimed in a demagogic fashion that if the federal government wants to hold back funds to police departments that use chokeholds, which is an illegal way to restrain a potential suspect, which oftentimes leads to that suspect's death, or if the police department continues to use no-knock warrants, that's when the police don't knock on the door. They just come through your door without knocking and start shooting anybody who resists. The Republicans claim that if you try to restrain and cut off funds from police departments who use such crazy tactics, that's something that will not go down well with them. And so the bill died. And so presumably, police departments are still authorized in many cities to use chokeholds, to use no-knock warrants, and this will continue to cause an escalation and rise of the deaths of citizens, particularly black American citizens.
Matthew Fogg, past studies have analyzed underreporting of fatal police incidents and how black Americans disproportionately die from police violence, but those previous researches, they were conducted over much shorter time periods. This report, it covered 40 years. Do you believe the manner of conduct has been the same basically for decades?
Well, I've been in law enforcement for 30 years. I've also been a police expert in law enforcement race issues for about 20 years. I've won a major case against the U.S. Department of Justice myself, fighting racism internally behind the blue wall of silence. I've been there. I've seen how officers can conduct themselves in ways that certainly is not part of our training, but it becomes a culture once you get on the job. And the problem is within law enforcement, and yes, the report is 100% hitting on. I mean, this goes way back. Like I said, for all the years that I've been in the U.S. Marshals and was a member in law enforcement, worked with dragnet operations all over the country, I had a chance to actually see it in place. And I'm with an organization like right behind me called Blacks in Government, and I'm also was the front page of a news article on my other side that says Bigots with Badges, which is my book that's coming out. But the bottom line is this. Racism is infiltrated. The FBI came out and did a report and indicated how many of these subversive, these very, what we call right-wing racist groups have infiltrated law enforcement. So it is a problem in America. It goes all the way back to the Hoover administration, back when Hoover over the FBI. I mean, we know that law enforcement has been a tool that has been used to actually, as Chief Justice Warren said, who's now deceased, he said the police officer is more powerful than the President of the United States because they have a right to forfeit a person's freedom, their property, or their life at any given time, according on what they perceive their discretion. So this is a problem, and it's a problem that we have to address in America. I've tried to do it with my job. I didn't become one of those police officers that waited until I retired. But I took on the system right when I was there and actually saw these things that we're talking about now, the chokeholds and what happened with George Floyd. And we could go even New York City Police Department when the mayor de Blasio spoke out about telling his black sons to be careful, and the whole half the police department turned their backs on him. So it is a problem in America, and I think right now with the whole issue of Black Lives Matter, these reports that are coming out, it's saying that this is just not conjured up stuff, but this is real, and we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with it, whether it's in Congress or whether it's marching, but it's got to be dealt with.
Mr. Horn, the study brings forth a grim reality here. Despite years of scrutiny, criticism, protests, calls for reform, no government agency tracks how often law enforcement officers in America kill people. Now, if that's the case, how can anyone ever follow up on these findings or pursue a path that leads somewhere in terms of making a change?
Well, that's a very good question. However, your audience should know that The Guardian, the London-based newspaper, interestingly enough, has been trying to keep statistics and figures on how many people are killed by the police in the United States of America, because obviously there are authorities in the United States of America that are not interested in collecting such data, because I assume they feel that it would be indicting them. Also, the Washington Post in the United States of America has tried as well to keep such figures. But to follow up on what your guest said, studies have shown that in Los Angeles, the second largest metropolis in the United States of America, in the sheriff's department, you have right-wing gangs that prey upon black men in particular, and even have certain kinds of games that they play to show that they have basically harassed or otherwise intimidated or worse, injured or maimed black men in particular. Obviously, this is a cofactor on the skyrocketing incarceration rates of black men in particular, although the rates for black women also are escalating sharply. The United States probably imprisons a higher percentage of its population than any other nation on planet Earth. And then there's the death penalty. Black people are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, subjected to execution by the state, and they're more likely to be executed if they kill a white person than if they kill a person who is not defined as white. Now, obviously, this is outrageous. It should not be allowed to stand. But once again, I think that we'll need pressure from the international community in order for this system of inequality, this staggering crime against humanity, to somehow cease.
Matthew Fogg, let's talk about Mr. Horn just mentioned the issue of the judicial system. Let's talk about the much-seen police impunity in black deaths. As seen time and time again, the judicial system is mostly in favor of the police, especially if the victims, especially if the police are white, the victims are of a community of color. Why is this common practice in U.S. courts?
Well, it just shows how systemic racism is. I mean, it just shows you that across the board. I mean, again, I challenge the U.S. Department of Justice, most powerful law enforcement, probably organization in the world, because we as U.S. Marshals work under them. I challenged it for race discrimination. In 1998, I got a landmark verdict that said racism was systemic within the U.S. Marshals. And today, I'm the class agent representing over 1,500 black U.S. Marshals, the same type of thing that is going on today. So what we have, we say, if it's happening internally, if I got to deal with a bigot with a badge working next to me, imagine what they're going to do to the public. So reality of it is that, yes, the court systems, everybody's in on it, and the reality of it is that until it becomes an issue in America where we start to address it, start to talk about it, it somewhat came out once this past administration, and we started having Black Lives Matter, and people started marching in the street. Then all of a sudden, that's where the George Floyd Protection Act came out. Now, the organization I'm with, Blacks in Government, we actually did a resolution, and we passed that resolution, telling Congress we supported the George Floyd Protection Act. But it's so much more, because what has happened is we're now beginning to see how entrenched America is on these issues. And as these reports come out, people are now asking the question, well, how can this be in America when we are supposed to be a land that says we're the country of the free? We have to address the fact that in law enforcement, like I said, I'm an expert on the inside. I know what we do. And what I'm saying is, and the culture is such that when you speak up, you become a whistleblower. Actually, you become the bad guy. Once you start speaking up and saying, this has got to stop, it's got to end. We did the same thing with the war on drugs. We took the war on drugs and we built one of the largest prison industrial complexes the world has ever seen, but mainly on the backs of African Americans. When I started noticing that, I brought that up to my managers. I said, listen, we're gonna stop going in the urban areas and making arrests. We're going to start going into some of these more affluent areas, these white areas, these areas where the most drugs and the best stuff comes from. He said, Fogg, if you go into those locations and you do that, he said, what's going to happen? They're going to have pushback. They're going to contact their congressman, their lawyer, their judge, whoever. He said, and then next thing you know, they're going to shut our operation down. So we have to understand it is internally. There are a lot of police officers, a lot of people recognize it. We see it. You don't have to wait for a report. You can actually see the studies, and you can look around you and see who actually goes to prison for these crimes and who don't, who gets a break or whatever, a privilege we call it in America. So it is a problem.
All right, Gerald Horn, researchers, they identified places where misclassification of the deaths often occurred, noting that medical examiners or coroners who must fill out the cause of death when there's suspicion of foul play, including police violence, they can be embedded in or work for the police departments. Now, if the medical examiner, a coroner, or other certifier fails to indicate police involvement in the cause of death on the death certificate, the incident, it could be misclassified. How concerning are these findings?
Well, it's extremely concerning. And what you just mentioned points to a structural problem, a structural flaw in the criminal justice system. It's not only that the coroners and the medical examiners oftentimes work hand in glove with the police departments. These are their comrades, these are their colleagues, and they're very unlikely to present data that might be indicting of their comrades and colleagues. The same holds true for the prosecuting authorities. That is to say, prosecuting authorities are reluctant to bring criminal cases against police officers who break the law, because they too work hand in glove. They too see the police officers as their comrades and colleagues. And then you turn to the law itself. Right now, in many jurisdictions in the United States of America, you have this regulation or law called qualified immunity. What that means is that a police officer, generally speaking, can kill, steal, or rape and not necessarily be found liable. if someone wants to sue them for damages. It's also unlikely, I'm afraid to say, for them to be found guilty of a crime because of the structure of the law. Once again, we can't begin to understand this outrage unless you understand the system of slavery, unless you begin to understand that system, which basically equated black people with being akin to horses, mules, and cattle, not part of the human family. And to this very day, there's that lingering idea that black people were not part of the human family. And since there has not been a sufficient interrogation, not to mention excoriation, of that particular canard, that lie, that outrage, the system continues to persist.
And one quick question, get a final thought from Matthew Fogg. We were talking about the issue of medical examiners and coroners. The practices are showing that racism is occurring not just during the encounter itself, but even after the individual has passed away. Does this show how deeply embedded systemic racism is in different aspects of American life, most notably in issues pertaining to health?
Well, if someone said it's walking, breathing, driving while black, and death while black. And yes, I mean, the reality of it is that the country has not relinquished its past, and it continues to hold on to that past and the remnants of the past. And like I said, being in law enforcement, having been on the front lines, and having been wanting to be a part of an organization that would say equal justice. But when you're talking about racism in America, I mean, it's just not there. And we as black law enforcement officers, the other officers who recognize it, we owe an oath and a duty to this country and a service to this country to stand up and report it. But yes, you are correct. The disparities are there 100% in just about everything we do.
Thanks a lot. That's all the time we have. Allow me to thank my guests, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also thanks to Professor of African American Studies at University of Houston, Mr. Gerald Thorne, joining us from Houston, Texas. Also, special thanks to you, our guests, for staying with us on this issue of Spotlight. It's good night for now and bye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to your program, Heavenly Grief. Today we have our esteemed guest, Sheikh Muhammad, from the Islamic seminaries in the holy city of Qum. Today we're going to talk about the demise of the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, son of Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Sheikh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me, and thank God for giving us this opportunity to talk about Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam.
Indeed, a great person, indeed a great honor to talk about him.
Yes.
Dear Sheikh, can you elaborate, can you talk about the livelihood of the Prophet? How did he live? What was his teachings?
Mm-hmm. Well, about the Prophet, talking about him is very difficult at first, since such a person and such a character in history cannot be described or cannot be talked about by people like me. But studying the history and especially narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and also the narrations from the life of Rasulullah, it gives us a good and clear picture about the a way that Rasulullah